So maybe start. Today is my last of the six lectures I had the pleasure to give you, and so we are coming on the last day to one of the seminal issues and thematic priorities of East German cinema. Normally, one could also say one has to start with this topic, with a question how East German cinema dealt with the Nazi past of Germany, because it's one of its most important commitments. I have chosen to reverse a little bit the secret, not to start with the things which everyone expects to be of first priority, but to end with it, because I think that in the late decades of the GDR, it has achieved its most important contributions to this subject. Nevertheless, this is why this topic, how the Nazi past is represented in East German cinema, one has to go back to the beginnings of DFA again. So we always have today another little travel through the complete DFA history under a certain specific aspect. Namely, how DEFA as a film producer started in 1946. First of all, before I start with telling you something about most important movies in this regard, however, one has to establish the notion, or one have to take note of the notion of anti-fascism and anti-fascism as an ideology for the communist dictatorship, how it emerged. It was one of the central features of this state. Of course, it goes by itself that for the communists in power and the GDR was by definition an anti-fascist state. It was led and directed by anti-fascist politicians who themselves had fought actively against the Nazis already before 1933, but in particular after 1933. And one has to keep in mind that, however, anti-fascism was not just designating this sort of personal attitude or engagement against Nazi power. Interestingly enough, in the eyes of the communists, not everyone who had somehow opposed Nazism could count per se as an anti-fascist. And this was a consequence of a definition and an understanding of fascism and of the right way to fight it, the proper way, the politically correct way, so to speak, to fight fascism. And the understanding of communist ideology, not just in East Germany, but everywhere where you would follow the communist dogma, fascist regimes such as the one in Italy, in Spain, and of course also in Germany, represented the most extreme form of political power in the interest of capitalism, of financial capitalism in particular. Fascism was considered as a form of terrorist domination in the interest of big monopoly enterprises and of the finance capital, which was directed against all other classes of the population, not just the working classes, but of course also the working class and the peasants, but also against other segments of the middle classes, against the intelligentsia, in short, against the overwhelming majority of the people. And in this view of fascism, and this is very important in our context today, neither the anti-Semitic and racist ideology of Nazism, nor its genocidal realization, that is the Holocaust, featured as a key element. The murder of the European Jews was considered in this doctrine of fascism, or how to explain fascism, just as another side aspect among others, among all the crimes which were committed by Nazi Germany. And in this narrow reading of official anti-fascism, it was rather the war against the Soviet Union, which ranked highest on the list of Nazi crimes. And so anti-fascism and defending the Soviet Union was more or less put into one pot. It was more or less identical. If you were not a fervent defender of the Soviet Union in this view, you could not be a good anti-fascist. Of course, in this ideology, communists claimed to lead the anti-fascist struggle against these fascist regimes, both in terms of politics and in terms of military fight, in terms of armed resistance. And one can say that the communists claimed this leadership to some extent with quite some success. First of all, they could show that they had really heavily engaged in this battle because they had lost a lot of cadres in the fight against fascism. In particular, most evidently, the communist state power in place, the Soviet Union, contributed decisively to overthrow Nazism in the course of the Second World War. And this is why after 1945, when reconstructing the destroyed societies in Europe, East and West, communists claimed to have fought most consequently against fascism and therefore also claimed to interpret the true spirit of anti-fascism and also claimed political power. Just remember that also in states like Italy and France and even Belgium and other, in the very beginning after 1945, communists were part of the new liberation governments because, of course, also the other political partners would concede them that they have decisively contributed to resistance, to overthrowing Nazism. And only when the Cold War evolved in 47, then the communists were excluded from government in these Western democracies in France and Spain, France, Italy and Belgium. It has, however, and this is important just as a side remark, so that you do not equate anti-fascism per se with communist ideology. It has to be underlined that there has always at the same time existed, so to speak, a non-communist understanding of anti-fascism, shared by social democrats, by Christian democrats, by liberals, or anarchists, or whatever sort of orientation of a, say, let's say, libertarian, in the broad sense, democratic inspiration, and which was not connected to the communist cause per se. At least in these times, in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the communists claimed to interpret anti-fascism in their specific way, but they were competing with others. What is important now is that with the foundation of dictatorships in East Germany, anti-fascism is not just a sort of attitude and orientation which could unite people of divergent beliefs and orientations. It could become a state ideology in these states in Eastern Europe. So, when these communist dictatorships were established, anti-fascism in the understanding of communists became a sort of founding ideology. And this in turn had the consequence, everyone who had doubts about this anti-fascist ideology or its proper interpretation could be branded as an enemy of the people, as an enemy of anti-fascist ideology. And if you were branded as an enemy of anti-fascist ideology, you quickly could be branded as a fascist per se. So this was part of the Cold War drama developing after 1947, which made it that anti-fascism then over time gained, so to speak, as a slogan, a ambiguous and or ambivalent meaning. This is why nowadays it's not any longer claimed in a self-evident way. Most people who would declare themselves anti-fascist today would make specifications in order not to be confounded with this very narrow meaning which had been established by communist rulers in the 50s and 60s. Of course, when communicating anti-fascism to the East German population as a new state ideology in the GDR, the leading politicians of the Communist Party had the advantage that most of them personally had been active in resistance against the Nazis. They'd either spent quite some time in concentration camps or in prisons, or they had fought the Nazism from exile, being from Western exile, but in particular, of course, from exile in the Soviet Union. This was one part of the story which made it credible to some extent. But there was also another part. Remember that the East German state was based on being the other, the contrary, the good other, in contrast to the bad other, which was West Germany. Germany was always portrayed by the East German propaganda as the evil per se, the evil alternative to the own country. And what every contemporary could see there on the other side of the border in West Germany was that there, in particular after 1949, when the Western Allied kind of retreated from governance, when the West Germans built up their own state, the Federal Republic, which was a liberal state, nevertheless, a lot of former Nazis came into professional positions in the state again, returned, so to speak, in their old functions. You would have at the top leadership rather respectable liberal or social democratic politicians, but on the second rank already you had quite a lot of old Nazis taking positions in administration as judges, as administrators, also in the economy, resuming their positions again. So West Germany had to live with the reputation to sort of be very soft on old Nazis. And this even went so far that East German leaders would characterize West Germany as being a new fascist state, a sort of clerical fascist state, because there was a strong influence of the Catholic Church, which historically speaking was widely exaggerated, because nevertheless you had the rule of law, you had a liberal state, you had free elections and so on in West Germany. But the embarrassing feature, of course, was that there were a lot of Nazis in positions, former Nazis in West Germany. And this is also why, particularly during the 50s, some of the movies which DEFA produced, which refer to West Germany at this time, deal with such stories about old Nazis getting into positions, local leading positions again, and which at times could create some scandal. And you would have filmic narrations, plots, so to speak, a little bit like crime stories, and so on, which deal with this presence of the Nazis in West German society. I will come back to that motive in a moment. It can therefore be said, safely said, that anti-fascism became the founding ideology of the East German dictatorship, and thereby its most important legitimization, because it had quite some appeal among the East German population, in particular among young people. Young people being disillusioned by the Nazi regime, which sought for new orientations. And it also, and this is the second aspect of this ideology, which is very important also with regard to the film we speak today, this anti-fascism ideology established a hierarchy of victims of fascism and of their official recognition by the state, which concerned things such as the entitlement to restitution and material recompensation and entitlement to specific benefits. In the communist state, a difference was made between so-called fighters against fascism, who would get preferential treatments, they would get higher pensions, for instance, preferential treatments in the healthcare system, and these were on a better level of treatment than the so-called mere victims of fascism, Opfer des Faschismus. So Jews, for instance, persecuted by the Holocaust policy were regarded in most cases as mere victims. They didn't, in most cases, hadn't shared in the sort of resistance the KPD, the Communist Parties, had set up during the war. They were not part of these organized structures, and so only the very thin stratum of organized resistance fighters, mostly of them communists, but also some social democrats or other people, got the recognition as fighters, as Kämpfer, whereas the other ones were kind of second category of victims regarding entitlements such as recompensation for time having spent in jail, in concentration camps, or preferential treatment in the healthcare system. In terms of dealing with the past, this anti-fascist ideology therefore had two consequences. It did not thematize, this is one important thing since it was so much focused on resistance, it did not thematize very much the extent to which Nazism had been supported by the population at large. And the population at large supporting Nazism, if you think of the 50s, was still the population in place. So also the DDR population was consisting of people who 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier still had been, for their majority, been supporters of Nazism. So anti-fascism, the ideology, would kind of gloss over this. It would say the real Nazis are all over there in West Germany, and anyway Nazism was a thing of a tiny little elite of very evil leaders and manipulators at the top level of society. It was not the work of the society at large. This was part of this explanation of fascism as being an instrument of the monopoly capitalism to terrorize society. So this spared, of course, also the East Germans the confrontation with their own responsibility for fascism, and kind of turned every GDR citizen into a retrospective anti-fascist. So you would have communist leadership with 60 million anti-fascists, which, if you would exaggerate a little bit the argumentation. This was the ideological offer in this ideology. And on the other hand, this ideology presented communists as the model case of anti-fascist resistance fighters, leading to a very stereotyped notion of anti-fascism and marginalizing all other elements and and forces fighting against communism, and also marginalizing all other victims of fascism. So the victims of fascism, which happened to be communists, were the ones which were exposed in public celebration and commemoration, whereas the other victims were kind of glossed over. Interestingly enough, of course, in the West German case, you would have a reversed logic of representing fascism, which is part of this East-West entanglement at that time. In West German political education from the 1950s onwards, you would focus also on a small clique of criminals, Hitler and his leading circle, but with no relation to capitalists or the economy, and who would be held responsible for the Nazi crimes. And the mass of population was depicted as victims of betrayal, seduction, manipulation, brainwashing, etc. And also this implied that normal Germans were, properly speaking, not really responsible for the Nazis, that they were betrayed, could not know what the real goals of the Nazis had been, and that they somehow then were forced to join the war effort, and that they would not have known what happened to their Jewish neighbors, etc. This was also a way to gloss over the responsibility of the majority of the Germans, but not by giving them the noble title of retrospective resistance fighter, but by uniting them into a large community of victims. Almost everyone was victim, except for the evildoers at the top of the Nazi leadership. And this victimization ideology then was extended also to the end of the war, when the large part of the German population became massively victims of the Allied war effort, of course. So this was all mixed up in one victim community, one can say, which would not differentiate between whom was the cause and what was the effect. So the victims of expulsion from the eastern territories, the victims of the air raids from the bombing war were also counted among the victims of war and tyranny. And this was, so to speak, the mirror image of the East German anti-fascist ideology. In this West German narrative, resistance against Nazism, if it figured at all, focused on very singular stereotyped cases such as the conspiracy of Wehrmacht officers around the Count of Stauffenberg, who in July 1945 had attempted to kill Hitler, and other resistance activities, in particular those of the communists, were not mentioned at all in this West German ideology. So if you see this complementarity and its contradiction between the West German and the East German version of how to deal with the Nazi past, it's very clear that for the very sense of identity of East German, of the East German state, this anti-fascist belief, so to speak, had a fundamental function. The East German politicians and to some extent also the populations which had some sympathy for them could not think their own new state without relation to this anti-fascist ideology. Now let's switch to the question, how is this dealt with in cinema? And you have to consider that cinema production in this country was monopolized by the state. It was run by a central institution, the DEFA, and it was steered by experts for propaganda and culture in the Ministry of Culture and in the Central Committee of the Communist Party, who could make very direct decision on what which themes, which topics had to be treated in films and which were of minor importance. In a market-driven film economy, where you would have several producers of films, producers would look out and for the audience and the audience tastes in order to decide which themes and topics to offer. And this would then show a totally different distribution of themes and topics when you have this kind of state censored and state-controlled enterprise, then of course the state has a strong say in deciding what should be treated. And this, in the case of the GDR feature movies, about which we talk here, had the astounding effect that from the approximately 800 feature films which DEFA produced from 1946 to 1992, from these 800 feature films, more than 100 were devoted to the times between 1933 and 1945. That's about 13%. And this is very much, if you compare it with market-driven economies, where, well, there's quite always a large segment dealing with historical themes, but just one specific period in time, which covers 12 years, and which has a very strong potential for contestation and for raising heated discussion, which would eventually not be so popular with the audience. To devote 13% of the whole production to this topic is rather exceptional. So dealing with the Nazi past was a key feature from the very early DEFA films onward, also from the term before the GDR itself was born and before the Cold War started itself. I had already mentioned one of the most famous DEFA film, the very first one, which came out in 1946. Die Mörder sind unter uns, the murderers are among us, which deals exactly already with this question that these post-Nazi societies had to grapple with the fact that former murderers, Nazi murderers, now were being demobilized from the Wehrmacht, returning from the front, getting back into their regular professional positions, we are now living amongst us, that the neighbor next door could be someone who had committed mass crimes at the Eastern Front, who had managed to cover this up and then had returned into his very regular, so to speak, petty bourgeois everyday life. And the whole drama of this film is revolving around the understanding, the insights, the moral dilemmas which are derived from this experience. In a way, in the end, the lead character wants to do something like private, take something like, execute something like private lynching justice or private revenge by killing his neighbor, who he has identified as such a war criminal, but is prevented from doing so from a victim of which had survived the concentration camp, because she teaches him this will not be the way to handle the future of our society, basically. So in the end, it's a very muted and ambivalent ending, kind of discussing, kind of showing this dilemma was an important contribution to the first 4 or 5 years of the German inner German debate about the Nazi past, and therefore this film is always standing, so to speak, as it has a very important, he's regarded as one of the most important contributions to the way in which a German film could treat the Nazi past, but one cannot yet insert it, so to speak, in the East German or GDR heritage of filmmaking, because it was still made in a situation when there was no Cold War, when the director Wolfgang Staudte himself, who is a West German, was a West German, could freely move back and forth between East and West and produce this film in the Soviet occupation zone. Another film which was even more popular in German at the time, and which also belongs to this pre-Cold War period, where there was not yet so much antagonism about which would be the right anti-fascist ideology, is Ehe im Schatten, Marriage in the Shadow. It was a huge success. I think in this early time it was the most successful German movie for a long time, with 12 million people at the box office. It was one of the movies which were shown all over the place in Germany, not just in East Germany. And it was done by one of the then long-term and real important figures of East German cinema, the very young Kurt Metzig. Kurt Metzig, who also has contributed to DEFA history with this Thälmann film, with these big monumental biographic picture on the communist leader, and later on to one of the films which were forbidden in 1965, the Rabbit film, so to speak. I had mentioned that last time. So Kurt Metzig then was a very young man. He had during the Nazi time joined the communist underground resistance movement, but had lived in Germany as a film technician. He had maintained a laboratory for film for stock, and then he was one of the founders of the DEFA. He had a very personal relation to this story, because this is a story about a marriage couple of actors, theater actors. The woman, being a Jew, is denied and prohibited to perform from 33 onwards, and so this while her husband makes a career as a very popular and actor, and being so to speak honored also by the Nazi leadership, and the Nazis put pressure on him that he should divorce from his Jewish wife, which he will not accept. And then the career is at stake, and the man is put under much pressure, And before giving in to the Nazi pressure, they both commit suicide in the end. So it's a very tragic and, so to speak, unhappy ending film. The biographical background is that Kurt Metzig came from such a so-called mixed mixed couple. He was his mother was a Jew and had committed suicide during the Nazi period. So he had a very authentic and direct motivation to expose this drama. What is interesting in this case, whereas the Mörder sind unter uns stylistically is also already trying out to experience with open air shots. It's set in the rubble society, rubble landscape of Berlin. It's very expressionistic in its visual presentation, and is using the landscape, so to speak, the rubble landscape of destroyed Berlin as a metaphor for the state of destruction of society in general. Ehe im Schatten is very conventional in terms of acting, in terms of a typical studio production. You would see this is coming directly from the old style Ufa way to produce melodramas. It was criticized, of course, by some film critics for this kind of traditionality. Nevertheless, and this was why it was so effective, it was appealing very much to the audience's tastes. So people would run into this film and think this is really one of the central dramas of one of the evils that had been done to our neighbors. This was a time still, 45 to 48, where such things could be thematized in the German public, because this was a time when there was a forced shock of realization what Germans had done during the war to their own neighbors and to people in other countries. This sort of first public wave of apprehension, of realization, was then closed by the Cold War, when these other ideologies, the anti-fascist ideology in particular, was put in place. Just a hint to the essential reading on this first phase of films in DEFA production which deal with the Nazi past, and these two films are mentioned there also, is by the American German literature specialist David Bethrick on the Holocaust film Before the Holocaust. That's how he terms it, because the Holocaust, in inverted comma, as a subject has become universal only later, in the late 70s. I mentioned that yesterday already, when this TV series Holocaust got published and shown in first in the US in 1978 and then in other places in the world in 1979 and after. It's from then time on then one refers to the murdering of the Jew as the Holocaust, whereas in the years before you would speak rather of the murdering of the Jews or of the annihilation of the Jews, but not take this originally biblical term to designate it. In this essay by David Bethrick, he goes through a number of other films established in this time, shot in the 50s until the middle of the 60s, subscribing basically to the new anti-fascist ideology. And what is typical in these films is that there were also films dealing with anti-Semitism and the persecution of Jews, in particular films like The Bloom Affair or Rotation, which are films dealing with resistance with persecution of individual Jews, but they would not put it in the center of the story as the main aspect of what Nazi rule and Nazi terror would be about. And in particular, they would not engage too much into the ways in which this was supported by, so to speak, ordinary Germans. What is interesting is that such themes aspects of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish persecution were still, could be still thematized to some extent in the 49-50, but when DEFA entered into its most bleak and unproductive phase, that is the middle of the 50s, I had talked about that in the first lecture, even such still somehow differentiated treatments of the subject became more or less impossible. And the, so to speak, the embodiment, the symbol for this very single-minded way to depict fighting against fascism and the understanding of fascism, again, is this monumental movie Ernst Thälmann about the Communist Party leader murdered by the Nazis, also a film by director Kurz Metzig. Now, you can imagine very well, if I said 13% of the whole production of DEFA, that is about 100 films, were devoted to the history of Nazism, it's easy to devote whole lectures, lecture series only on that. It's a specialty of research, meanwhile, in the community of DEFA, film, DEFA historians, and so I won't go into the details of this subsection of the whole DEFA oeuvre more specifically. What can be said that, just to make it a little bit shorter, that the thaw period after Stalin's death then led to a sort of relaxation of pressure and censorship also on cultural production, and this also made it possible to have more innovative efforts to represent the Nazi past in DEFA films. I had already pointed to two outstanding films by Konrad Wolf treating the persecution of Jews and in particular also the Holocaust. One can say that Sterne, Stars, movie on the left side, is one of the earliest feature movies describing the setting, the historical setting in a concrete situation in Greece, where it is about deportation of Greek Jews to Auschwitz and the love story between a Wehrmacht officer and a Greek Jewish woman, which ends tragically. This was one of the very first German films who kind of played out this situation in a very concrete and precise way. It got some popularity in the Eastern Bloc because it was a GDR Bulgarian co-production, so it was distributed widely in the Eastern Bloc countries. It gained a Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival in 1959, so it was recognized also among the cineasts, but it was not getting popular in West in the western half of Europe. So we can say, firmly say that also among all outstanding film artists of the GDR, they contributed to this anti-fascist strand of films, Konrad Wolf among them. Now, since this today's lecture is also devoted to another outstanding film artist of the GDR, let's get to Frank Beyer, who was man of the... Right? There he is. One of the most productive film artists, directors of the GDR, and one could say, next to Konrad Wolf, the most important eye. If you look back in historiographical terms. Frank Beyer, born in 1932, died only 3 years ago, came from a middle-class family. He had studied dramatics and film, and interestingly enough, he had started studying drama in East Germany right after the Second World War. And also already had worked in some publishing houses, and then at the beginning of the 50s he moved to Prague and entered the Film Academy in Prague, where he then did his diploma, so to speak. And if you look at his filmography, you will see that the first two titles are Czech productions, which he produced at this school. I do not know that, and I do not know whether they have any relevance in the Czech canon. I guess not. Then in 1955, after he had finished his exam, and this 55 movie is his, so to speak, final exam, his diploma film, he became part of DEFA in Babelsberg. He went back to East Germany, and already the first four films in the row here are only devoted to themes of the Nazi period. The film, first film as a director in 1957, deals called Zwei Mütter, Two Mothers, is a story about a mother adopting a child of a woman who has to go underground during the Nazi persecution. And so this woman takes care of the child. Then later on, after liberation, the woman comes back and claims her child. And you have this typical situation of where should the child go, to the adopted mother or to the original mother. That's a topic which already is popular from other novels and plays. Bertolt Brecht has dealt with this theme, also had put it to the context of Nazi Germany. So it was a typical personal story set in this context of Nazi persecution. 1960, Five Cartridge is a seminal film about an episode in the Spanish Civil War, or also there fighting against fascism is in the center of the story. It's very emotional. It's a, so to speak, a very intelligent war film of the anti-fascist point of view. 1962, Königskinder or Royal Children is a love story set in the context of Nazi dictatorship and Second World War. It's about a couple separating because he, the boy, is arrested as a communist resistance fighter, and later on, after he had been deployed to a Wehrmacht unit, he deserts and joins the Red Army. And then rejoins, after very complicated relations, his girlfriend after the war. So this were the first films where already Frank Beyer's strong interest for dealing with human experience in the Nazi time fully visible, but however still always coached in this thematic field of communist resistance, of how communist people of which were devoted to the communist resistance fight would have to take decisions, which dilemma they were brought in. The actual symbol, so to speak, of or the epitome of this filmic representation of anti-fascism according to the ideology of the GDR state is the film Nackt unter Wölfen, Naked Among Wolves. And it deserves a little bit longer, some longer remarks. You can say among all films which deal with the Nazi time produced by DEFA, this one is the treating anti-fascism and treating the identity of the GDR state as an anti-fascist state, this one is the outstanding one. This is one is, so to speak, the canon, the most important film in the canon. Every student, every pupil in the GDR would have seen this film at least three times during his school times, and would have read the novel on which is it based, Nackt unter Wölfen, by Bruno Apitz, a former concentration camp inmate himself, who had written this novel in 1958. And the story is very simple, the story is very moving, and it's authentic. It tells the story of a group of communist prisoners in the concentration camp of Buchenwald, near Weimar, which managed to hide and thereby save a little child of Jewish-Polish origin. Somehow the child was smuggled in by a prisoner who came from the east, probably from Auschwitz. Buchenwald at the end of the war, 44 to 45, became the collecting point for a lot of prisoners being sent from Auschwitz or other regions where the Red Army would move in, which were then sent to the camps in the Reich itself. And so this little Polish child was kind of smuggled there and was hidden and kind of protected by the adult prisoners. This story of saving the life of the child is very dramatic. Of course, it's full of suspense and complicated situations. It depicts very carefully the terror regime, the procedures of the SS towards the prisoners. And it also shows very nicely the, or in a very impressive way, the dilemmas which communists who were organizing resistance inside the concentration camp were facing when trying to hide someone, because of course there were people objecting among the communist resistors. There were some who objected because they deemed this to be extremely risky to hide the child, that this would disturb the proper effort to organize resistance against the SS, to organize survival against the SS. And so what is important about this, in the end they find a solution to protect the child and nevertheless go on with communist resistance. Why is this so important in the case of Buchenwald? It is so important because at the same time Buchenwald has another myth going with it. The child story just came after the myth was already established. The basic myth of Buchenwald is, and the concentration camp of Buchenwald is, that the Buchenwald resistance group of communists inside the camp, the society of prisoners, so to speak, managed to organize a self-liberation just before the Americans came in. Buchenwald was actually liberated by the Americans. This was part of East Germany, which originally in the weeks of April, May 45, was conquered by the Americans and only later on then passed on to the Soviets. The mythical story goes that before the Americans came, the Americans were a little bit dubious anyway, Buchenwald inmates, the Buchenwald prisoners, managed to organize a revolt, a self-liberation. They would overturn the SS guards, and they had managed to hide weapons, some rifles and guns, and would kill some of the SS and take power in the prison itself. And you see this filmic mise-en-scene here when this liberation moment comes. The whole masses of prisoners running out of the camp, respectively overrunning the SS, the remaining SS guards. And then after this had happened, it was... This is the first element of a myth. I will later tell on how far the myth. Second element is that then these resisting groups, which were under the leadership of the Communist Party cell in Buchenwald, took an oath, a ceremonial oath, to fight against fascism, against any possibility that fascism should return, and to establish an anti-fascist order in Germany. This oath, among these political resistance fighters, among them also Christians and social democrats and liberals, became, so to speak, something like the foundation oath of the German Democratic Republic. This was what resistance fighters, what party ideologists would always return to, they would point to the oath that was taken or delivered, declared in Buchenwald in view of the liberation, of the self-liberation of the Buchenwald camp. The thing is, of course, historical evidence shows that it was not a real self-liberation. They had prepared for something like that, but it was the American who had liberated the camp. And the camp was almost deserted, and the people who were still living there were so in so bad condition physically that they were far away from being able to take up military fight against the SS guards. The SS guards had deserted by themselves, so a proper self-liberation was not feasible at all. There was then a sort of self-organization of the survivors in the camp, but this had to be, of course, assisted by the Americans. And then there is a second hidden story in this, which also was glossed over in the anti-fascist ideology, which is that this resistance group of communists which organized the party life inside the camp was always tied up with the fact that communists were the preferred overseers put in place by the Nazis, by the SS guards, overseers on their co-inmates, so-called capos. And as capos, they had some responsibilities in carrying out the plans and the, in particular, the work plans of which how they were imposed by the SS. This was always taking about taking decisions whom to spare, whom to save, whom to spare very hard and lethal labor, or who should be sacrificed. So these communists in place as resistance fighters at the same time were people deciding on death or life of other people, and they found ways to do so. But this, of course, was an aspect of this resistance fight which had been taboo and covered up during all the 40 years, which, however, the ones who had part of it knew about very well. So this is kind of a typical taboo area in this resistance fight, which was kind of overplayed by this insistence on the self-liberation and on the Buchenwald oath being taken there. The whole complex background of this story was only uncovered after 1989, when the sources were made accessible and could be reconstructed, the whole story could be reconstructed in a very detailed way. The important thing was that Buchenwald, the site in Buchenwald itself, the concentration camp site, established itself as the site of official, so to speak, anti-fascist ideology from the late 50s onwards. 58, the concentration camp memorial was established. A huge monument was erected here, kind of showing the spirit of resistance fight against Nazism and the SS terror, and also in view of this, so to speak, positive perspective of establishing an anti-fascist order. As an official site of commemoration, this was a place where every school class had to go once to spend the day there, being instructed by Buchenwald survivors, watching the film, reading the novel, etc. This was all one unit. And therefore, one can say that the novel and also the film Naked Among Wolves somehow embodied the problematic and also the rich potential of this sort of anti-fascist as a state-imposed ideology. It, in a filmic way, described living circumstances in a concentration camp to some extent, so there's a lot of realism in it. It also introduced, as a side aspect, the story of the anti-Semitic persecution, because the child in question is of Jewish origin. But again, it shows the Jewish character only as a passive victim who had to be taken care of by knowing communist fighters. And it idealized the heroism and the humanity of communist fighters, glossing over the problems that the organization of communist survival in concentration camps had, the dilemma of sacrificing the one and for or the other. In the case of this child, it is, one could reconstruct by archival evidence that, of course, he was maintained to the sacrifice of someone else. This is very clear. If we move on now, and this, so to speak, is the, you can say, this film, Nackt unter Wölfen by Frank Beyer in 1963, is the monumental film on where the official understanding of anti-fascism and film making, feature film of the GDR really became one. This is the film of this official ideology. It brought Frank Beyer a national prize, and so it established him as one of the most important film directors in East Germany. To continue with Frank Beyer's oeuvre, again, to relax somehow, he for the first time produced something like a comedy, Carbid and Sauerampfer, Carbide and Sorrel, farcical road movie set in occupied Germany in summer 1945, which had some one exceptional merit, which was exceptional in this context of the German Democratic Republic, because it was set in central Germany in 45, just right after liberation, after May 45. When I had told you the Americans were still on some part of the future GDR territory and the Russians next to them, and there is someone taking a travel from Dresden up to Wittenberge, which is already near Hamburg, and back in order to organize some tons of carbide for reconstructing the enterprise he's working at home. This is a very chaotic story to transport such a heavy load, and so he is confronted with these occupation force soldiers in very comic way to organize his survival. And this implies, since these are comic and farcical episodes, that also audiences, the viewer was allowed to laugh about Russian soldiers, which was sort of taboo until to that point, to laugh about Soviet soldiers per se, because the Soviet Union was a very dignified and heroic institution, which in filmic representation in the GDR context you were not allowed to laugh about. And so to speak, Frank Beyer managed to develop a story in which this was possible. One can say that this film also passed, because it was these years of between 63 and 65 where there was a certain liberalization setting in, where censorship was relaxed to some degree, and also this more self-assured stance towards some touchy issues such as the occupation by the Soviets in Germany, and the stories which were behind that could be touched upon in a mildly ironic way. The next outstanding work of Frank Beyer, I had already mentioned this, and there he turns to the present of the GDR society itself in an exceptional way, is this film Traces of Stone. I had talked about this 2 weeks ago, which was one of the these movies which then were hit by the ban after the 11th plenary of the Central Committee in 1966. It portrays a rebellious construction site worker played by Manfred Krug, and was going much too far in its very outspoken and critical way to handle problems of the SED, of the construction of socialism, and was kind of also taking as a culprit for the conservative, more dogmatic party functionaries to show to the artists that they are still the masters in the house, and these artists had subscribed to the dogma and the conditions which the party would impose on them. Now, this the banning of Spur der Steine was a crucial and one can say to some extent traumatic experience for Frank Baier. In a way, he never recovered in terms of productivity and frequency of production of high quality films. He was removed from DEFA Enterprise for 8 years. He had to go to television and do television productions of a more modest and less creative kind, adaptations, things like that. So for a long time he was not allowed to direct cinema productions anymore. The film in the center of our consideration today, Jakob der Lügner, had already been projected in 1966. Probably one of the reasons why it could not be carried out was that Baier was banned as a film director, as a director for the DEFA. I will come back to that later. Just have a short look on the remaining oeuvre of Frank Baier. There is Jakob der Lügner. There are other, we see several TV feature film productions. Among the one which after Jakob der Lügner but still done for DEFA and for the cinema, you will still have another one on Second World War, such as Held for Questioning in 1983, which is on a German Wehrmacht officer being accused falsely when he gets into Polish imprisonment in 1945 and nearly gets executed. He also did some movies after 1989, but one can say that he did not resume the same quality and intensity in filmmaking as he had achieved in his best years during the 60s and with Jakob der Lügner. Now, Jakob der Lügner. It started with the plan by Jurek Becker, a very important novelist of the GDR, of Polish-Jewish origin, who with his family had moved, however, to Germany after 1945. Who had spent some years as a child, you can see, 1937, so he must have been 8 years, six, seven, 8 years old. Had spent some time in a Jewish ghetto in Poland. He was a novelist, but also writing for cinema, writing scripts for cinema. He developed this original story of Jakob der Lügner, which he claims to have heard as by hearsay, as a story being told by his own father, who also had spent, of course, time in concentration camp and in Jewish ghettos. Originally it was meant as a film project from the beginning, started in 66, but then realization was thwarted, mainly or for two reasons. Basically, they had in mind to co-produce this with Polish partners who would not accept the treatment and this material, because in Poland this was regarded a too touchy issue, anti-Semitism and Polish society not yet being dealt with openly under the communist rule at that time. And the other reason might have been that Frank Baier, as a candidate for directing the film, was excluded after his ban in 66. So Jurek Becker just went another way and instead of finishing the film project wrote the novel Jakob der Lügner, which was then published both in East and West Germany and was quite a good success in the late 60s. Then in 1974, the project of producing a film out of the material was picked up again. Baier was kind of, graced to return to DEFA production again after having been barred from DEFA project production and as a director for 8 years, and so within a relatively short time, and in this case with co-producing with Czechoslovakian partner, Jakob der Lügner was put into place. And now let's zoom in a little bit on Jakob der Lügner itself, what makes this film specific in the context of the history of treating the Third Reich, treating fascism and anti-fascism in the context of GDR filmmaking. Now, we have talked about that there has been a little complication with the screening of the film insofar as you had only seen the subtitles, but the sound was not there. To some extent, this is ironic. I will explain later why. But you, I guess you got the main message, the plot of the story, which also dates back to the story Jurek Becker got told by his father. Someone, the idea that someone in a ghetto has a radio and has some news about the war efforts of at the Eastern Front of the Soviets approaching, and that this knowledge and this imagination of how things turn outside the world is kind of instilling hope and some kind of future-mindedness among the inhabitants of this ghetto. Jurek Becker takes it to a further point in his plot, as so far as he even presupposes that the ownership of this radio is an illusion, that this Jakob just by chance had some glimpse, some by overhearing some German radio news, could bring back this news to his neighbors, to the co-inhabitants of this ghetto, and from then on is taken into respected or regarded as someone owning a radio which could deliver such news and such messages, which then in consequence entails a lot of, so to speak, negotiation of also sometimes comic situation and of attempts to alleviate or to negotiate the own predicament in the ghetto and the own future. People taking hope again, not losing hope, not capitulating in face of the SS terror. As you have seen, the film then ends is realistic in that sense that it takes an unhappy end. The ghetto is not liberated by the Red Army, by the Russians, but the ghetto inhabitants are put on the railway and taken away, assumingly to Auschwitz or some other place of annihilation, as we all know. Now, what makes this film, which, so to speak, focuses on a particular instance and a particular, so to speak, part of the escalation of the genocide of the Jews, the phase where Jews were put into the ghetto in Eastern Europe, into ghettos at different places, what makes this film particular with regard to the conventions of narrating fascism and anti-fascism within the GDR context? And in this context, I would like to point your attention to draw your attention to this essay by Paul Doherty, Americanization of the Holocaust, The Case of Jakob the Liar, which you will also already will be handed out to you. He very nicely makes the main points what makes this film different from, so to speak, the conventional logic of anti-fascist myth-making, so to speak, and the anti-fascism as founding ideology in the GDR, as it is also embodied, for instance, in the film Nackt unter Wölfen, Naked Among Wolves, which was directed also by Frank Beyer only 12 years ago. First point, one omission, so to speak, and Doherty said there are also these films is very telling by its omission, by the voids it leaves. The first omission is, you could put under the heading, no resistance. No resistance in the conventional sense of organized, highly politically minded, and in the end, military resistance. There is no resistance group in that sense, that someone performs the role of a political leader is organizing a little group of devotees who then lead the whole community to a better future. This originally was always an obligatory element of such films. On the contrary, if we look at the main character in Jakob the Liar, this Jakob is a seemingly not very courageous figure. He's rather shown as someone very fearful and scared from the very beginning. On the other hand, and this is crucial in that sense, because it's evident these are Jewish people which are populating the scenery. On the other hand, he is not shown as a passive victim either. It's not that he's not acting at all. For instance, he hides this little girl and is nursing her when she's ill. He hides her illegally. It's clear that she is not officially registered living in his household. And this, of course, this motive is kind of picking up the motive of the Buchenwald child, kind of making a reference backwards to this sort of story. And by doing so, Jakob nevertheless is courageous and is someone assuming responsibility also under these very extreme conditions. But nevertheless, the fact that he becomes the source or the illusionary source of these hopeful news and stories he can tell, he's put into this position rather by chance, by inadvertedness, by the fact that he is called upon to go to this office of the SS to report there because another guard has mistakenly thought that he is in the street already after curfew. And he reports to the office of this SS guards, and there overhears the German radio, but since it's still before curfew, he's just sent home and comes away with it. So it's by mere chance that he's kind of getting into the seminal role of being regarded by his fellow inhabitants as someone being knowledgeable on the war theater, and he assumes this responsibility. He doesn't turn down the expectations of his neighbors, but tries to cope with them, tries to give them rewarding and hope-instilling answers. Of course, characterizing such a figure is an important step in the direction of taking distance from stereotyping, communist versus passive victims, communists always taking the lead and the other ones being the mere followers and the ones who only have to be helped. It's kind of breaking with this kind of stereotype. The breaking of stereotype, the kind of dismantling stereotype or just not paying tribute to them is also continued in or is also visible on other levels. It's remarkable that also the SS side, the Germans in place, are shown in relatively differentiated ways. Some are shown as Wehrmacht or SS soldiers just doing their job without always, as it is had often been shown, turning into sadistic monsters at every occasion that could occur. They are shown as people doing their duty, doing their job with not too much interest. Some are shown as brutal, but also in a contradictory way, when, for instance, the one guard, after having beaten up Jakob's friend Kowalski, because he has destroyed some load of in the train station where he had to work, after the German guard has beaten him up, he's some kind of a well, recompensation, or as a gesture, so to speak, leaves him 2 cigarettes, which was a quite important currency, so to speak, at these times. So the Germans are shown in a way which is not following, let's say, standards which were by then already well established, for instance, also in Hollywood filmmaking, about German Nazis behaving always in a certain fanatical, hysterical or sadistic way. They are shown as differing from case to case, and this also is part of this way to de-typifying the characters of such a drama. Then there is another element which is new in this context, which is something which up to this point, in particular in the context of dealing with the Holocaust and the persecution of Jews, was totally unusual, that is humor. What has been regarded, and this had been regarded as particularly innovative in Jakob der Lügner, it's of course a subdued and subtle sense of humor. There are little humorous scenes, they are not very intrusive, there are scenes which make you smirk but not laughter out loudly. Some of these comical scenes are of course predicated on the interplay of illusions, which is the base of this plot, someone pretending to have a radio and being asked by his neighbor and then finding ways to evade the confession that he doesn't have a radio, and when he does it really in one point, then the story really turns tragic, because his neighbor Kowalski, being ripped off his hopes, of his perspective, then commits suicide on the next day. So it shows how closely this humorous and the tragic side are intertwined, and why, so to speak, these humorous scenes were a matter of survival in this plot. So exactly this little episode with Kowalski committing suicide after he learns, as the best friend of Jakob, that actually Jakob has no radio. This shows very nicely that at no point in the drama humor overtakes the very, or overshadows the very serious of the situation of the ghetto itself, that death was lurking, so to speak, around every corner. And also another episode shows this very clearly, when one of the inhabitants is killed by an SS guard because he wants, against prescription, get into contact with passengers of a railway car standing there in the in the station, in order to communicate them the good news that the Russians are already relatively close. So the vicinity of this hope and the comic and farcical, so to speak, side it involves for us as onlookers, and the grim reality of living under this terrorist regime of a ghetto are very evident, and so you can never say the humor kind of glosses over the seriousness of the situation. My view of interpretation of the function of humor in this plot, I think, is that this humor is another way of the authors, of Becker and Bayer, to re-establish the, so to speak, non-heroic humanness of these actors, of these figures, without glossing over the deadly serious conditions which are imposed on them. It makes it possible for us as onlookers, as audience, to see these people as people in their own right, with their frailties and self-deceptions, their weaknesses and their strong sides, but not as, so to speak, figures on a chessboard of higher powers, of the omniscient international class struggle of history with a big H, so to speak. And so I think this is an important merit, to show us, or to give us the possibility to imagine people under these conditions as people who can act on their own behalf, which we do not have retrospectively to subsume to some kind of major historical truth for which they have sacrificed their life or things like that, as it was the self-evident logic of this anti-fascism ideology. This sort of restraint from dogmatic, so to speak, theoretical explanations of history is also strengthened by the fact that this storytelling has no direct or evident authoritative narrator. It's a sort of de-ideologization which is supported and in the beginning, very important, in the beginning established by the abstention from any claim of objectivity. Objectivity, the claim, this has happened that way, we show you now, Buchenwald or whatsoever, was an important message, an important claim of this DEFA style of anti-fascist films. People should believe that what they see now is more or less exactly how things had happened. Jakob der Lügner starts with a statement, written statement, the story with Jakob probably never happened this way. Certainly not. But perhaps it did happen that way nevertheless. We do not know. It's a story heard and could have happened, but we are not sure about it. It's, so to speak, we are called upon to imagine this, but not in order to believe it word by word and picture by picture, but to imagine how people could act under certain circumstances. And this, so to speak, appeal to our subjectivity, to our imagination, is then again supported by the fact that always from time to time inserts are put into the narration where the inside view of these figures is shown in these flashback to their normal life before the ghetto, where we see whether what kinds of jobs they pursued as a hairdresser or as a restaurant owner and other things, and where we see that imagination, living in your own subjective world and having your own imaginative relation to the world, is a very important matter of survival, but also a very important matter, very important means for us to imagine how things could have happened without claiming by the narrator, by the filmmaker, that it had happened exactly that way. And if you do not believe it, you might be on the wrong side of history or whatsoever. Next and fourth element, which is very important and which distanciates this film from other films, is that, of course, in contrast to other anti-fascist movies of the conventional kinds, it has no happy ending. The fact that Jakob's lies cannot hold forever, that they cannot prevent the ghetto's inhabitants from being deported, is a departure from such conventional anti-fascist mythology, and there is no attempt to raise the viewer's feeling of compassion over this historical knowledge, which we know that it ended that way. There is also no, so to speak, sacrificing gesture which says, well, now for this day the battle is lost, but there will be a brighter future or so, which you would have in other films. Also, if the concrete story itself ends in a bad way, then there would be a kind of outlook into a brighter future where future generations will take on the legacy of these victims and so on. There's nothing like that. It's just the film is ending, and it closes only on the vision of the little child looking through the window of the railway car and getting told by Jakob the nature of these clouds, which were part of a fairy tale she was told. But this is, of course, couched in the terms of a fairy tale from which we all know it is a fairy tale and nothing else. It's not the promise of a brighter future transcending this horrible story and obliging, so to speak, or a kind of engaging the viewer for the cause of, let's say, anti-fascist ideology. This is left very open, rather unprecise. It only appeals to our sense of humanity, but not to our sense of, let's say, being anti-fascist, a virtual anti-fascist resistance fighter or so. So in a lot of respects, this film pays tribute to some historical realities in a very concrete way, which had been distorted and misrepresented in the conventional, so to speak, self-serving anti-fascist drama of heroism and sacrifice, as it had been the convention in East German filmmaking so far. You see very clearly put that the Nazis could rule and terrorize large part of Eastern Europe, the ghettos included, without meeting much of resistance. There were not resistance fighters at every corner, and not everywhere there was a communist cell organizing the People's Front against fascism. On the other side, the non-communist victims are shown here not as passive lambs going to the slaughterhouse, but as reasonable people trying to make the best out of their situation with hope and fears, with their little strategies to alleviate their pains. They are shown with their sense of and capacity of agency. And we as posterior spectators cannot assume responsibility for dealing with this part of history. This is the message of the film. If you do not acknowledge the human nature of these actors, do not put them on the side of passive victims, so to speak. And this also includes that we do not let ourselves be comforted neither by unreal happy endings of martyrs, jesters, or by sacrifice of a better future, which was the convention in normal DEFA films. This should not be enough for us. We should look out for how we can pay respect to these victims in their property as human beings, which have their own way of acting under these extreme situations. And this is more important than paying tribute to this kind of state ideology of anti-fascism. Now, one final remark to this interesting film. The way through which this story could work at all, without arousing too much contention and protest, is, I think, and there comes the ironic twist that you heard it without sound, is the extreme atmosphere and calmness and silence in which this action is set. If you have ever read something about what the Nazi ghettos were about, the ghettos they established in order to put the deported Jews from all over Europe in Poland mainly, you will know that these ghettos were extremely crowded, that overcrowding was a principle of their management, putting as much people in this place as possible, thereby also killing some substantial part of it because hygienical conditions were extreme. If you see footage or photographic evidence or biographies, read autobiographies from how it was like to live in the ghetto, it was always overcrowded, it was always noisy, there were everywhere too much people. You have a slight allusion to this in the fact that the young lover and the young loving couple has to share this room with a neighbor, and where there's a comic scene where they divide the room. And the neighbor has to pretend that he is deaf in order so that the love couple can spend its night there. But this again is shown in a rather practical manner, whereas normally you would have a two-room apartment being crowded or settled by, I don't know, 10 people or so as the normal situation in a ghetto. This all is absent. This is a ghetto where there's a lot of space, it's relatively calm, there's not much noise, it's in a way a acoustic and visual emptiness which is prevailing. And I think although this is rather irrealistic in terms of historical accuracy, I think of course it's showing us this is a way how it could have happened. I remember the claim in the beginning of the film, this could have happened that way, but it certainly has not, but maybe nevertheless. But I think what is more important, this void leaves place for imagination. It engages us to think and to imagine how it must have been like, how it could have been like. It engages our sense of probability to look closer at what we can see there. kind of unpopulating this imagery of Nazi repression, and one of the typical sites of Nazi repression, the ghetto, taking away all the resistance fighters, taking away the masses. You won't have running masses which run for liberation or so, is a way to engage our imagination, to look closer at what we can see singled out as individuals. And in a way, I think this is important if we set this film in an international context. We know after Jakob der Lügner, later on, you would have other very important movies, for instance, engaging with similar motifs. The most prominent, of course, is Roberto Benigni, Life is Beautiful, where humor as a way to resist and survive plays a crucial role, which is also very imaginative in its plot, and where pretense and, so to speak, illusion is a seminal way to show an act of survival, and which, however, pays some tribute, of course, to Holocaust, Hollywood expectations as far as the good ending is concerned. And, of course, in Benigni's case, it's not the Russians who are coming, but the Americans who are coming. Nevertheless, one can say, I think such a film as Benigni's was only possible after some other films went much more the quiet and calmer way, after some sort of this stereotyped anti-fascist myth has been put on the side, so that a new way to see such things could become possible and establish itself. It has to be seen that Frank Beyer's film can be regarded as a contribution to this long-term development, and so far as it was well recognized in when it came out. It was displayed in 1975 on the in West Berlin at the International Film Festival, and I had the pleasure to be at that performance a long time ago, and to see the in the discussion the team of filmmakers Vladimir Brodsky and all the other ones. Brodsky won the silver medal for the best male lead act at this Berlin festival, and interestingly enough, one of the main arguments in the discussion which Frank Beyer then made, because he of course was asked by journalists, isn't this a little bit too belittling the horrors of the Holocaust, what you show there? It's this mild humor, and the, isn't this a kind of belittling the horrors of the Holocaust? Or at that time one would not say Holocaust, but genocide. And he would answer, no, we had shown so much, given so much information and shown so much things to the East German audience on Nazi crimes, on persecution of the Jews. We know that people can compensate, can fill up, so to speak, the empty void, the empty space, and the things we leave not outspoken with their own knowledge. We can trust on the knowledge of the people. This is why we can do it this way, the film. We are reckoning with the state of information of the viewers, and thereby focus on these specific situation and the humanity of these figures in place. I found this at the time a very bold statement, but it is important insofar as, of course, this was a tongue-in-cheek statement. He said, well, we know the GDR citizen and other people are well informed about the basic facts of the murdering of the European Jews. But what he always also said indirectly, of course, was we know exactly that people would appreciate if in such a story not the it is not the obligatory communist resistance fighter who was portrayed as the most important event of the stories, but the victims and their agency themselves. And I think in this regard, this film was sort of paving the way for a new approach in representing the Holocaust in cinematic productions, in feature films. What was, of course, pushing the theme, establishing it on a large international scale was, again, there one comes back to the hegemonic force in cinematic culture, was the breakthrough of the Holocaust theme in the United States with this TV series in 1978-79, which was screened in large parts of Europe. And in the aftermath of this Holocaust series, then you would have a new generation of films making their ways, new ways to represent the Holocaust, and just the two most important, you will certainly know them, are on the one side Benigni, La Vita Bella, and Schindler's List on the other side. In Schindler's List, by the way, you have a very nice, precise picture of how crowded and overcrowded a ghetto actually was. So there you can see the contrast. But I think someone like Schindler could do this picture only after such films as Jakob der Liebner had been made as a sort of transition, so to speak. I had included in this essay of Doherty, or in this essay of Doherty, included there's always a nice comparison with a second adaptation of Jacob the Liar by David Kassovitz from 1999, which ironically follows much more stereotyped exigencies of what a Holocaust or anti-fascist film should be about. Doherty comes to the paradoxical conclusion that this expectation to which Kassovitz pays tribute in his film, namely that he introduces a resistance fighters group, he introduces a positive perspective in the end. He stereotypifying. He introduces a lot of stereotypes regarding the characters, the Germans, but also the Jews. He's introducing much so-called Yiddish humor, which Jurek Becker does sometimes only in a very, very modest way. So this Hollywood adaptation of 1999 ironically corresponds in some extent more to the original anti-fascist myth expectation than what Frank Beyer did in 1975. This is a very ironic contradiction between these two versions, which have to do, of course, with the fact that in the American culture, remembrance culture of the Holocaust, which is tied up to cinematic culture, some certain laws of serving the audience expectations are crucial among them, this elating, comforting dogma of a good end. Frank Beyer with his movie, I think, has made an important contribution to opening up this perspective, and in this sense is standing in another tradition of cinematic representation of the Holocaust, which is still worth remembering, and which I think is among the most important contribution of East German cinema to the international cinema culture. And with this, I would like to close my lecture and thank you very much for your attention.